Feast, which you can get to at nanetsfeast.com. And I am delighted to be talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, my friends, my listeners, my family, my lovers. Welcome back to the Days Gone By radio program of the air. This is, of course, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am very excited to be talking today to an expert in several different fields, one of them being the English language, because she has been an English professor for several years. Also, because she's an expert in food. She's been a cook. She's been a line cook for a couple of years. And most of all, she is a movie expert because she was helping run the Criterion Collection for more than a dozen years. These are the people who put together the classic movies and put them out there for all of us to see. So it is a pleasure and an honor to be talking to Nan Bauer here in the neighborhood. And first of all, shalom, Nan.
Shalom, Rabbi.
I was supposed to be Reverend.
I'm so sorry.
Reverend? Toy, Reverend. Where the hell did that come from?
I don't even know.
I take it you're not Jewish.
I was carried away. I was transcendent listening to you.
Well, it can be. Oh, yeah. I tend to move people, or at least their bowels, something along those lines. But anywho, you are not Jewish. This is correct, eh?
I'm not. I'm a total wasp.
Oh, gosh, shiksa yet.
Yeah, totally. Bauer, about as German as it gets.
Whoa. So what was your grandfather doing in 1943?
He was over on this side. He actually escaped from Russians under a hay cart in 1902. So we're on more common ground, I think, than not common.
Oh, so you ran from the Russians, which is good, or he did.
Yeah.
What about the other side of your family? Are you German all the way around?
Well, I think the other side is sort of classic mutt. You know, there's some German, some French, some Danish, some all sorts of things.
So you might have some Jew in you, even.
I would love it. I would be ecstatic.
That's right. Or if you date a Jewish man, you would get some Jew in you. I don't know what that means. Anywho, Nan Bauer, now, you're not doing this now, this Criterion thing, but for a few years, you were the editorial coordinator and a producer at the Criterion Collection. Sorry?
I have to correct you because you said a dozen in the intro and it was only six, and I also don't feel I helped to run it. I was very privileged to work there, but it was an awesome gig. It was totally great.
So, all right, already you're lowering my estimation of you by a lot. Were you sweeping up clippings that they were doing on the Steenbeck? What were you doing there?
I was a little higher in that. But I was, you know, the editorial coordinator is, it's a lot of, I had to bring in all the English teacher stuff, you know, like proofreading and making sure nobody's name was spelled incorrectly. And also, I think one of the funner parts of that job was to talk with a lot of the really wonderful film reviewers who I had been reading for years and years, like Andrew Saris, would go to lunch with, and Terrence Rafferty, so that was really fun.
Now, Saris was at the Village Voice. Where was Rafferty? He was from where?
Rafferty was with the New Yorker for a long time, and I am not sure if he still is, because I'm not getting the New Yorker now that I'm not one.
But
he was there. He also, he writes, you'll see him do pieces for the Times. He has a book called The Thing Happens, I think that's what it's called. Oh, God, I should go look on the bookcase.
The Thing Happens, okay.
Yeah.
Not the most interesting title, but okay.
It was a John Huston quote.
I figured.
And he was saying that with movies, sometimes, you know, you can't really describe it. It's kind of like the great William Goldman quote, nobody knows anything. You know, it's vague, but it says it all, so.
And speaking of William Goldman, this is someone that you interviewed at one point, right?
Oh, my God. I actually even broke his TV. I love William Goldman, and I was devastated to break his TV.
What the hell happened?
Oh, God, it was awful.
First of all, tell everybody who William Goldman is.
William Goldman is the legendary Oscar-winning screenwriter and also a novelist. I think everybody knows, if you know William Goldman, you know he's a screenwriter, but he also wrote a bunch of novels. But you will know him most definitely from The Princess Bride, which is his favorite book that he's ever written. He said it's the only one he likes. And that I happen going to be able to work with him when Criterion produced a special edition laser disc, which was awesome, of The Princess Bride, and that has not been translated over yet, just because film rights are a very complicated thing. This was something I learned when I was working at Criterion, how tricky those get. Now, everybody loves Criterion, everybody wants Criterion to produce everything, and that's a fantastic thing. But back in the 90s, we never knew what we were going to be able to produce or not. So, William Goldman, I went up, he lives in a hotel on the Upper East Side, at least he did at the time, and
he's
I hung
like
out
Eloise.
With him for a while, and that was really cool,
yeah.
And interviewed him over, I think it was about a 4-hour interview, because he is like a jukebox man. You put a nickel in and the guy just talks, and he's got great, great stories. But then, at the end, one of my coworkers and I took up a LaserDisc player, because he didn't have one. And do people even know what LaserDisc players are?
Enlighten us, but it involves playing something with lasers. This I can fathom.
I'll tell you, LaserDiscs are, once, when my daughter, who grew up at the Criterion Collection, she was about 5 years old, we were walking down the street, and somebody was selling LPs, and she said, "Mom, what are those black things that look like LaserDiscs?" LaserDiscs were these big silver, they looked like a record, but they were the first digital format to watch a movie, and Criterion basically invented the special edition LaserDisc that had the movie in its original aspect ratio. You can thank your Ooh. Criterion for introducing letterboxing into the movie world.
Well, wait, didn't they do that on some special VHS tapes where they tried to keep the rectangular look of the movies? Sometimes.
A couple of directors insisted on that. I believe one was Woody Allen, because they would do a thing called panning and scanning, which was described by pretty much every filmmaker I ever talked to as an abomination. Do you know what panning and scanning is?
I'll make believe that I do.
I'll pretend. Okay. Panning and scanning means that the movie is rectangular. It's in a typically... what is it? A 2.35 to 1. Oh, God, that's so technical. Nobody gives a shit, but...
Wait, I'm falling asleep here.
sorry. Nobody cares.
Actually, you know, it's not that different from what you can now do with your TVs, where you can zoom into something while you're watching a show or a movie. You can magnify, you can go all over the screen, even though that's not the actual look that the director had in mind for that shot. So people can actually pan and scan themselves.
Exactly. And they used to routinely, in order to get the movie to fit on a square screen, they would chop off the ends of it, and then the panning part meant that they would move the camera from different places on the picture that you were seeing. But a lot of people, I know that when people saw... West Side Story for the first time, letterbox, because we had all grown up with it flat on the TV, filling that square up. It was like watching a whole new movie. So, but yes, you are absolutely correct, and I believe Woody Allen was, if not the first, one of the first who insisted that Manhattan be on the VHS with the black bars. And early on, when people saw those, they thought their TV was broken. They thought something was wrong with the tape. But Criterion introduced that into the mainstream, such as it was, even the LaserDisc. I mean, talk about a niche market.
You know? Yeah, what happened to it? It was like after 3 years, just it was swallowed, I guess, by the DVD revolution.
DVD came along, and they were just... Initially, people just like... LaserDisc could only fit 30 to 60 minutes, so you always had to change the disc right in the middle of the movie, and that was one of my jobs, was picking where would we break the disc. And
I gotta tell you, I got a hernia lugging Claude Lanzmann's Shoah around. It was like 37 discs for that stupid movie. Oh my God.
Seriously, yeah. It's it was not ideal for movies like that. That would have been a really?
I had a friend who was crushed to death by Berlin Alexanderplatz, I'm telling you. Just so dumb. But anywho, so wait a minute. So okay, you're bringing a laser disc to William Goldman, who does not have one.
I'm bringing a player to his house.
Okay.
And William Goldman is the uber in the quarterfinals or if they were just starting. But we take up, so he can see the disc. He's really delighted with the disc and how it works and very excited. And he was just such a wonderful, lovely guy. We set up the laser disc player to show him, and I go home for the day. And I come back in the morning, and there are four messages on my phone at work. This is before cell phones, too, so people can't call you, you know, at all hours of the night.
Right.
And the first one is, back then I was Nancy, not Nan. I said, Nancy, my TV's not working. It has to work. The NCAA playoffs are on. I got another call. He's even a little more panicked. Now I'm starting to block it out because I don't even remember. I was so mortified. And finally, I get a call where it's just a, and then a click.
Oh, God.
I called him the next day, and I said, oh, my God, what did I do? What did I do? And he said, well, you broke my TV. And he said it had to be working. It was just a nightmare. But he said, I finally got the guy in who came, you know, the guy in the building who got it all rewired so I could watch the game. And I said, do you want me to come back up there? And he said, no, I don't want you to come back up there.
But you didn't break. What happened was you put the wires wrong or so. You didn't put the
wires. We put the wires wrong. Yeah. That was it. And he's like, he's not a techie guy at all. I mean, he had to be kind of coaxed into even doing the laser disc. But then when he found out, you know, he could talk about his favorite movie, then that was good. But, yeah, and then I sent him flowers, and I think I sent him something else. And then he called me a couple days later, and he said, you've got to stop sending me things. And I said, I just feel terrible. And he said, don't feel bad. I got a great story out of it. And I thought, well, that is a fantastic attitude to have.
That is. I wonder if did that ever show up in any of his screenplays or books, a story sort of based on that?
I don't think so. You know, by the time he was not writing nearly as much by the time I met him. This was in the late 90s, and he was pretty much retired, so I don't know that it ever showed up, and honestly, I've never looked very hard because I'm still mortified when I talk about it, but, you know.
Well, can you remember any of the really cool, fun anecdotes that he told in those 4 hours before you wrecked his life?
I can, actually. I think one of the funniest ones was he said that there's a rule where you never let the writer on the set. And so do you know The Princess Bride pretty well?
Pretty well. Have fun storming the castle. I wish I'd got... I could have done that role so much better than Billy Crystal. Or Carol Kane, for that matter.
Well, they brought him on set to do the... Because he actually adapted his own screenplay, which is very unusual. That hardly ever happens, but he was so protective of the novel because he loved it, and he actually, one of the things that's really interesting was it had been bought, and Norman Jewison was going to direct it.
Always loved Norman Jewison just because he had those first three letters of his last name.
Seriously, and he's not Jewish, isn't that wild?
And he directed Jesus Christ Superstar, so I have lots of reasons to hate this man, but the name... That name.
The name is awesome. Okay. I think he's a great director. I never did meet him, but I think he's a great director. But name it. He actually directed it, and he's Canadian, which is kind of wild. But he told me that, Goldman told me that initially that had been, the opening sequence with the kid had been in black and white, and he remembered that. But then the movie Sound Around never got made, and he bought the rights back, which was kind of a big deal. He was very proud that he had done that. Anyway, when Rob Reiner came to him, Goldman really loved Spinal Tap. He thought it was a great movie, so he agreed to work with him, but he wanted to adapt the screenplay. So they get him on set, and it's the day when they're in that forest, and the rodents of unusual size come out, and those fires keep popping and starting.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first fire starts. Robin writes... dress catches on fire exactly like it's supposed to, and Bill Goldman screams out, her dress is on fire.
Oh.
Completely ruined the shot. And he said, and that's why they really didn't
don't
want to let me
writers on the
very
set
often. So but he told me that was a great story, and gosh, there were just so many. He talked a lot about, one of the things that was cool about the disc was we actually found that Rob Reiner, years before, had done an audiobook version of it where he read the book, and there's a whole sequence in the book about how when they go down to get Wesley out, I can't remember the character's name. What says it? Andre the Giant and Billy Crystal.
Oh, yeah.
It's not Billy Crystal, it's Mandy Patinkin. When they go down to get the guy out of it, they have to go through this big zoo and fight off all these creatures. So I remember Bill Goldman talked about that, but he said there's just no way that, you know, we could have done it. But he was really, he was just delighted. He said he remembered, this is kind of sad, Andre the Giant didn't live a whole lot longer after that movie was made because he had something to do with his giantism actually shortened his life. And
irony Bill right there, giantism shortened his life.
At the end, she jumps out of the balcony and he catches her. And he said, Robin Wright weighs like a button. I remember
right,
he specifically said she weighed a button. And he said there was this look on Andre the Giant's face just of this terrible pain, and he said right then he knew something was wrong. So anyway, but it was just a really great experience for everybody, and action-packed shoot, and
And do you have any memories of either writing the book or dealing with the movie of Marathon Man? Any horrible dental stories?
He told me a great story. This is actually really funny because my boyfriend is a dentist. So he said...
Wait a minute, is your boyfriend Jewish?
No, he's not.
Oh, God. You're not even with a Jewish doctor?
I know. Something's wrong. So I don't know. My karma just ended up strange in this lifetime. But,
So Marathon Man. Bill Goldman
had something happened to a tooth when he was in Los Angeles, and he had to go into a dentist. And he said it was one of these kind of big Hollywood sleek offices, but they were sort of just separated by these cubicles. They didn't have real walls. So he's out there, and he's lying in the chair, and they're about to put him on there, and they said, oh, so what do you do? Because he says, in Hollywood, the first thing everybody asks you is, what did you do? Because they all think that you're a movie person,
right.
And so he said, oh, God, do I say it or do I not? And he just looked the assistant in the eye, and the dentist, and said, I'm the guy who wrote Marathon Man. Throughout this entire office, suddenly it was just dead silent. For like half a minute, and then they got back to work. But that was all I heard. I did always hear a great story. Now, this is apocryphal, or not apocryphal. I just heard this story. This is not straight hand through Criterion, which was that Dustin Hoffman, when he shot that torture scene, he's a method actor. So he went like 3 days, didn't eat, didn't sleep, drank coffee, smoked cigarettes. And so he goes in there and he's a real wreck. And Laurence Olivier says, Dustin, what are you doing? And so Dustin Hoffman says, well, I got to get into character and I got to do this. And apparently Olivier looked at him and said, Dustin, try acting. It's so much easier.
And now, of course, all those people, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, they basically phone in. They're like, they get a script and say, oh, okay, I'll be me.
Yeah.
But back in the day, Dustin had to do a limp, he had to do the voice, he had to look like this, and De Niro would go up 50 pounds and down 30 pounds. Now it's just like, oh, okay, give me my paycheck and let me do the role. And they're often just as good, We're talking, by the way, with Nan Bauer, and we're talking about her years at Criterion, for the Criterion collection of movies, and you still haven't really quite made it clear. You said you did some editing, proofreading, what, like a movie would happen, or you would deal with it, what would you do?
Well, it would depend. At Criterion, back then, it was pretty evenly mixed between special editions, which were, you know, all the bells and whistles, and you had an editing, you know, the director commentary track, so you would interview as many people as you could possibly get on the film who had been involved with it, and that would get edited together into a commentary track. There would be special features if you could find outtakes, deleted scenes, even kind of background information for some of the older, or the movies that had a historical aspect to them. For instance, I remember Sid and Nancy, we actually found footage, the producer did, of the real Sid and Nancy. And so that would be a special edition. The editorial coordinator has a lot to do with the movies that don't get a big special edition, that are important foreign classics, but not necessarily something where, you know, for the Seventh Seal or Seventh Samurai, you're not going to track down, you know, Toshiro Mifune, who's probably wasn't even alive anymore at the time, to talk about it.
But you would find a film professor who could.
You could sometimes, but they and that was very much how they started, but they tended to get farther away from that. And then in that case, one of the things that I did, which was one of my favorite things to do, was to not just check all the subtitles, but get someone, a native speaker of the language, to go over the subtitle script with me and make sure that it was actually syncing up, because there's a real art to subtitles. That was big. All the packaging, now Criterion has this book of all of its packaging for 30 years. That was the editorial coordinator's job, was to, you know, make sure that that was all accurate and work with the writers. And, you know, one of the things, the chapters on, you know, how a DVD
right.
still has chapters. That was one of my jobs, was chaptering and coming up with cute titles. And then I actually did move into producing, which is more glamorous. I mean, editorial coordinator is, I thought was a fantastic job, but it, you know, it's a lot of kind of English teachery stuff, no question. I also wrote a lot of marketing copy, you know, for like, I would write like the synopsis and stuff like that.
But then, and by the way, what are some of the movies that you worked on as editorial coordinator that you were responsible for?
Oh, gosh. Well, some of the special editions, I you know, the one that immediately comes to mind is The Red Shoes. We did a big, huge special edition of that was just gorgeous. Martin Scorsese is a huge fan of Powell and Pressburger's, who did incredible movies. You know, they did Black Narcissus and Colonel Blimp and The Red Shoes and A Matter of Life and Death, all these movies. Let's see, some of the ones that weren't special editions where we brought back the David Lean Dickens movies, Great Expectations and Oliver Twist, they were really wonderful. Fantastic Japanese movie that is not as well known outside of like film geekery, Sancho the Bailiff. Shortcuts. Robert Altman's Shortcuts was one of the first things I worked on.
That was a new movie at that point, though. That wasn't it.
That was what?
Wasn't that a pretty new movie by
then? That was new. Yeah. At the time, Criterion was working with New Line, and so Shortcuts was one. Actually, Seven was a big special edition that I didn't produce it, but I spent a lot of time looking at all those journals that are in the movie, those creepy journals that, you know, Kevin Spacey's character writes in. So we scanned those and put them in as a special feature. So it was a lot of just looking at everything and making sure it was getting in there in the right way.
Now, you moved from that into more of actually producing some of these
yes.
editions, which, how is that different? This involved what?
Producing is more like you're kind of it's almost like you're a director of a play, you know? You are looking at all the material you can possibly find on it, and back then, the budgets were minuscule, so you were really getting anything you could for free, which was, you know, kind of fun. But first thing you would do is you would get in touch with the director's assistant and just say, this is what I'm doing, can you help me with this, that, and the other, who do you think I should talk to? Because they have, Criterion still does the director approved, which means the director wants his stamp on. Wait a minute. Maybe they're not still doing director approved. They've changed the name to something else. But in any event, at that time, that was what we were doing. One of the things that was a lot of fun was when I worked on Evita, the Madonna Evita, my Peter Becker, who was still the president, said he thought one of the most interesting things to do would be find any footage I could of the real Eva Perón and use that. And, you know, once again, that was ended up being a really terrific special edition Laserdisc. So,
okay.
All 700 people who bought Laserdisc.
But wait a minute, didn't that then transfer over to a DVD version that was also special edition?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know what happened to the old, you know, we had big master tapes of everything we ever created, but I don't believe, because when a studio gets the right to redistribute that on DVD, most of the time, rather than buy the old material, they'll just create their own.
Oh.
I think that's sitting in the Criterion vault, but it was pretty cool. I did manage, amazingly, to find some footage of Eva and Juan that I could afford, and you know, she was a fascinating story. The only person I talked to on that was Alan Parker, the director, and also Madonna's hairdresser, which was awesome. But
well, at least it wasn't Madonna's hairdresser's hairdresser. That's as close as
exactly.
Most people could get. But,
no,
but how was
Parker
Alan?
Was cool. Alan was awesome.
Alan Parker was quite a talent. I mean, his movies range from Fame to Pink Floyd's The Wall, The Mississippi Burning. Was he a fascinating guy to talk to?
He was wonderful. He's the kind of guy you really want to kind of hang out and have a drink with. He and there were four guys. They all started in commercials in England. And he was one, the Scott brothers, Tony and Ridley. And the fourth one was Adrian Lyne, who we haven't seen much since 9.5 weeks. I think he did that new version of Lolita, but I don't know what Adrian Lyne is up to. But in any event, they were all kind of cutting commercials at the same time and learning the trade. And, you know, I mean, four really formidable talents. But what I love about Alan Parker is he's one of the guys who made fantastic musicals after nobody was making musicals. Because if you look at two of his, I think his two best movies are Fame and The Commitments. People forget
The Commitments,
which is just, I think, you know, one of the great rock movies. I mean, what a great movie. So he was a blast. He was really, really terrific. And one of the things that was great was he gave me a copy of the shooting script to work with, and he had drawn little cartoons of every single shot that he wanted to do. And there are a lot of directors who do that. Hitchcock did that. Terry Gilliam is very big on that. I never met Terry Gilliam, but I would listen when people would get commentary tracks. I would listen to what he had said, and he seems to be like one of the coolest people in the world. So
I wouldn't be surprised. And for Hitchcock, in fact, when he would make those doodles and do the drawings and the cartoons, and what do they call that?
Storyboarding.
Oh, sorry?
Well, it's storyboarding. It's kind of storyboarding.
Yeah, but for Hitchcock, once he had done that, he was already bored. He wanted to move on to the next movie rather than shoot the one he was about to, because he already had it in his head, and he mapped it out, and he storyboarded it. The film was done. Then the whole thing of rolling cameras, dealing with actors, waiting for the right light, he hated that. It was like already, you know, not interesting anymore.
Wow. Well,
I need to reread.
I read that book about Hitchcock years back in the 80s. Remember that? It was called The Dark Side of Genius. But I need to reread because I just think
he probably told that to Francois Truffaut even before that book.
Actually, that's and that was why, you know, we did a lot of the Truffaut movies. In fact, the first movie I had to check subtitles on was The 400 Blows, which is a personal favorite. Yeah, so, and then I went, oh my God, this is like the greatest job ever. This is really cool.
But I am curious. Greatest job ever. You loved the first editorial thing, then you got into the producing, but you were only with Criterion for 6 years. Why?
Well, I had kids, and we basically, my ex-husband now, but at the time we were married, we kind of ran out of money, and just kind of hit a string of bad luck, and ended up needing to leave the city.
Oh, I was wondering it.
Yeah.
Well, this was in New York, right?
We were in New York.
Yeah.
We were living in Brooklyn, actually, and then I ended up in Michigan because I have family here now, although none of us, you know, I grew up in California. I have one of those, you know, checkered paths across the United States. But,
so, well, actually, I'm curious. What's the most checkered part of your past? Share.
Oh, God. I was crazy about movies because I wanted to be an actress at one point, and I went to New York and, to act, and I met my first husband there. Now, this is way a long time ago, in the 80s, and then he got really sick, and we moved to Florida, and then he died while we were living there, and then I ended up back in California with my family, and so that's probably the most checkered.
There's nothing, that's
eventually,
not
I ended
checkered.
Up back in New York.
I'm sorry, that's not checkered, that's just tragedy. I'm sorry, I didn't
mean that.
I mean, unless you were humping his corpse or something, that would be checker than sick. But you didn't do that. No, it's just, well, to go from California to Michigan, that's, you got to buy a whole new wardrobe.
Then we went from California back. I ended up going back to New York after California, but there was a pit stop in Ohio. It's really...
So what was waiting for you in Michigan, the teaching?
No, nothing, actually. I mean, we were in pretty dire straits, so just family. And then what happened was I started to, you know, I found a house, and I had never lived around my family before. At that point, my parents were both here, and I still have a sister who's here. And oh, my God, I have a place to put my kids, and I don't have to spend, you know...
Yeah.
$200 on a babysitter because I want to go out. So it just became to, you know, I think one kid in New York you can do and not be making like gazillions of dollars, but two kids in New York, you really need to be making a fair amount of money to make it happen. And it just wasn't, you know.
Let me tell you, the producer of this radio program, the host, Dave, whom I know very well, he and his wife lived in New York all their lives, and it just became absolutely untenable financially for them to get along. And they don't even have kids. They have dogs, for crying out loud. And they call them dogs.
What part of New York did he live in?
Well, they were in Long Island. Long Island. Jewish enclave, I admit. High taxes, very expensive. But they were broke. It was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. No, then, it's too bad because when I went, when I originally went to New York when I was like a young, you know, stupid actress who thought I was going to conquer the world, you really could be a starving artist there. So I don't know how kids are doing it. I mean, they say they go to Williamsburg, but it seems just as crazy and expensive out there as it does anyplace else. So.
Did you ever appear off-Broadway?
Off-off.
So what's the show you did, and what was the theater?
There's some famous people in the show that I did. It was a, what was the show? It was called The Secret Lives of the Ancient Egyptians, and I got a 2-line favorable review from,
Who? Mel Gussow?
It wasn't Ben Brantley. It was some other guy.
Well, it wasn't Frank Rich. What year, when was this?
This was when I moved back. This was in, 93, I think.
Might have been Frank Rich. Unless it was
it was somebody who never quite ascended above.
Maybe Wilborn Hampton.
But the theater, the company was called the Cucaracha Theater, and here's the talk about tragedy. I was on a double bill with a play that starred Adrian Shelley. Do you remember her?
Oh, talk about tragedy. Yes, I do. She was a pretty
red-headed... Yeah, that was terrible. When I saw that, I went, oh, my God, Adrian. Because I hadn't stayed in touch with her. We weren't, you know... The other person, though, who was in...
Wait. Let's remind people. Adrian Shelley was this actress. She was in a bunch of Hal Hartley movies. And then she hired some workmen to fix up her bathroom or something. And one of them ended up strangling her to death. Very sick kind of a...
And tried to make it look like a suicide. Oh, God, it was so horrendous. And she had just completed that movie that people were going nuts for called Waitress.
Right. Oh. Yeah. Okay, so that's the... So who else was in this show?
The other famous person who was in it was Damien... Oh, my God, I can't remember.
The painter guy? No, Damien...
Damien, the guy who played Lisa Kudrow's husband in The Comeback.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I can't remember. I could look it up, but I didn't bring my oh, wait a minute.
Well, Damien would be a good omen. Just kidding.
He was very funny. He reminded me a lot of John Cleese, and he was that I was in.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, very funny. But, that was it. And it was kind of like, you know, I got my review, and I went, okay, I don't want to do this anymore because I was, you know, at that point I was writing a lot more anyway, so...
And you have directed theater at some point, somewhere?
I directed a show last year. I don't know if you know who Dawn Powell is. She was a brilliant writer, contemporary of Dorothy Parker, and many people believe actually had more depth and more range, but things never quite happened for her. And in the 90s, a writer named Tim Page, who was a really wonderful Pulitzer Prize winning author. He's right now working on a biography about Virgil Thompson.
Oh, so he's the music guy.
He discovered Dawn Powell and wrote wrote the definitive biography of her. And she did a play, and I wrote to him, and I said, hey, I'm going to direct this play by Dawn Powell. And he said, oh, I've got to come and see it, because I used to live in Ypsilanti, Michigan, which is right down the road from Ann Arbor, which is where the play was. So Tim Page came and saw the play, and Dawn Powell's, it was her aunt who's in her late 80s, and she came up from Ohio to see it. So that was really cool.
But you directed this for what, the college?
No, I just did a community theater show. There was one here, and I wanted to start directing because I was doing some video production, and I thought, it's one thing to quote unquote direct someone and say, you know, hold the coffee cup closer to your face, and I thought, you know, I wanted to get back to my theater roots. So
nice. So are you going to do more?
Maybe. I don't have any plans right now. You know, I'm kind of working away on the website, getting stuff up, building.
Now, this website, again, is nanettesfeast.com, and we want to spell that Nanette. It's got what? Nanettes, feast.com. Might as well tell people what they're going to find when they get there.
Nanette's Feast is about, basically, I call it no excuses dating. We're very insular at this point, but we all need to date. So I encourage people to do that at home. And combining my knowledge of movies with my knowledge of food from being a professional cook, I tell you how to put together a dinner and a movie date at home. And using movies that you can find on Netflix, because having been a Criterion for a while, I tend to look for things that are a little more obscure on Netflix and maybe hidden, but that I think are really great movies and I'd like people to see them more. And consequently are really good date movies, because they've found that when couples watch a movie together and talk about it after, they actually, it's as good as a couple therapy session. At least that's what this one guy who has this theory, he's a professor from the University of Rochester. He did a test group, and he said, oh, wow, they don't need to go to therapy. They can just watch
movies. They can just watch. Well, it depends on the movie. They're watching. I wouldn't pick 7 for date night, you know?
Yeah.
That would not be the one. Oh, it's her head. Oh, that's good.
And then, I don't think David Fincher movies were real high on the date night.
Most likely
not. But, you know, you never know.
Yeah. Whereas Lesbian Nurses 3 That would be on my definite date.
That would be quite a date. That could end up being quite a discussion, actually.
Hell yeah. Oh yeah.
Anyhow. Is that on Netflix?
I don't know. Does Netflix have that kind of movie? I don't even, I'll have to check.
Here's a tip for Netflix. If you watch a movie, like, for instance, Blue is the Warmest Color, movie that came out, I think it was about a year and a half ago, French movie, two beautiful young women who are in love, lots of sex, and so if you watch that, Netflix will start serving you up its pornier titles.
Oh!
Yeah, this is how you find this.
Well, this is like the Amazoning of America. If you order a Keurig coffee maker, it's going to start showing, would you like a book about coffee?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, do you want to hear Benny Goodman's Java Jivers or Duke Ellington? It'll link all these things together.
Absolutely, yeah. And they'll serve you some sort of, you know, sexy European movie you've never heard of, but it's got, like, naked people in it. So, yeah.
Thank you for this. But this has been a very informative phone call. Thank you.
Probably the most valuable thing I said the entire time.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, my God. Thank you, Nan Bauer, for that bit of information that you can really skank up your Netflix subscription thing. But the other problem is, of course, if the Lego movie gets a good review, right? Which it did. And you order the Lego movie, suddenly you start getting, you know, My Little Unicorn 5.
All the product movies show up, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. But do you stay on top of, no pun intended, do you stay on top of movies now, or are you still kind of stuck in the era that you were dealing with in the Criterion?
No, despite the fact that I think people should watch movies at home a lot, I still try to get out very much. It's Oscar season, you know, so there's like all these big important movies, and I'm like, oh God, I've got to get out, because I don't like to talk about, I don't really like the Oscars that much anyway, because first of all, I think they ignore some really great stuff, and then...
Exactly, like Angel Stewardess's 5. How they overlooked that, I do not know.
How dare they? But, so it's just like, I've got... But I do feel like I need to sort of know what's going on, because it's the conversation. So, I saw Interstellar, and I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan, so that was absolutely no problem. Did you see that?
I haven't even heard of it, to be honest.
It's a big space movie. You know, they go in spaceships and they time travel, and Anne Hathaway wears a little space helmet.
Oh, now we're talking. Okay, there we go.
But also, it's not like Gravity, where Sandra Bullock was in her underwear, you know, most of the time.
I didn't even see that one either. Wait, you're
giving me... Oh, I saw that one, sure.
I'm making this whole list now. I got Anne Hathaway, I got... Oh, boy. Okay.
Blue is the warmest color, most important
Blue
one.
Blue is the warmest color.
I saw Birdman, because everybody's just going crazy over Michael Keaton's performance. So.
That sounds interesting. Was that not so
I don't... You know, I hate to talk smack about, because movies are so hard to make. I thought Michael Keaton was very solid. I didn't see him do anything really different if you paid attention to him as an actor. So I think he's just a good actor, and he does a good performance. Edward Norton is incredible in that movie. He is really great. The camera work is really something. It is something to see, because a lot of it's just moving around and going through these corridors in the theater and then going outside, and, you know, it's at one point Michael Keaton gets locked out of the theater and he has to run around in his underwear on through Times Square. I mean, it's...
Wait, I don't want to see Michael Keaton in his underwear.
The camera operator is very smart, so they don't really show much underwear. It's more just about...
I always see his beak.
Times Square when you're very cold, so...
Oh, well, shrinkage. Well, let me ask you, Nan Bauer, what are one or two of your very favorite movies of all time?
I hate this question.
I know. Besides Angel Stewardess's 5.
Don't leave that one out, but don't overlook 3.
Three was good.
I would have to say...
Three was in 3D, which
Goodfellas.
Is...
Goodfellas, watch whenever I'm depressed, because I think at least I'm not being chased by gangsters who are trying to garrote me. I love Goodfellas. I think it's a great, great movie. And let's see, if I go, can I do three?
Sure.
I would go back to The Lady from Shanghai, which is a movie that Orson Welles was kind of forced to make, and he was kind of pissed off when he made it, but I really love it. It's a great film noir, and...
Is that the one that hangs in the Hall of Mirrors?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I love that movie. And the other one that I'm pretty crazy about is Inception. I really like that.
Inception.
The one with all the dreams and Leonardo DiCaprio and spinning tops.
I lost patience with that one. I've got to admit, I didn't know what the hell was when, was where. I stopped caring. It's like those Lager Kaufman films. I love the being John Malkovich. I love the what's that other one with the Meryl Streep, the adaptation. But once he got to Synecdoche, New York, I'm like,
oh my god, that movie was just impenetrable. I thought I could not figure out what the hell was going on or what I was watching.
He stuck me in Synecdoche, Kansas, let alone New York. I couldn't even get to New York in that movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and I kept thinking, don't they mean Schenectady? I mean, it was like that. I know it was. They were supposed to do that with that title, but oh my god, yeah, that was a rough one.
Which was it? Because even Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, that's a lovely movie. That's a nice one.
That's a sweet movie. Yeah. That's not him, though.
That wasn't Kaufman?
He wrote it, and then the other guy directed it.
Charlie Kaufman, was it still Spike Jones? I can't even.
I think it was, actually. Or else that French guy, Michel Gondry.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. I'm confusing him, of course, with Spike Jones, because he did their Furious Face, which is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Well, being John Malkovich is a great movie. I love that movie.
Malkovich.
And I actually, you know what I think is the big surprise is Cameron Diaz, because you don't think that she can play ugly, and she's so amazing in that movie. I think she's going to have that moment where, like, she hits 45 and people go, oh my god, she's an amazing actress, so...
Well, she's all those actresses try to do that with the ugly stick for one or two films. When they try to prove, I'm either going to get raped or be a rapist. So that's what they have to do. What's her name?
I'm going to be pretty now. Yeah, I'm tired of that.
I'm just going to be horribly ugly like 99% of the rest of the female population in the world. Just to prove, you know, that I can act. And I'll have a limp and I'm going to die.
And I'll get fat.
Right, yes, and then the next 15 films I'll be glamorous again. But
yeah,
goddamn it, I've got something to prove.
Exactly.
Do not understand.
Are you looking forward to any movies that come out, or do you not even have time to go?
I'm still watching silent films for crying out loud. This F.W. Murnau guy, he has some talent, let me tell you.
He does. He's pretty darn good.
He could go somewhere. Snub Pollard. Whatever happened to Snub? Did you ever work on any silent films, actually?
I'm so mortified to admit this. I avoided silent films just like a crazy person. Other than, I don't think Criterion did a silent film the whole time I was there. And after I left, I decided it was a big gap in my film education, so I started to watch them all. And, you know, unfortunately, that means D.W. Griffith, which is Intolerance and Birth of the Nation, two of the worst movies. I know they're not terrible movies, but I find them just torturous to watch. But I did become very enamored of Charlie Chaplin. I had never really sat down and watched a lot of Charlie Chaplin, and I really fell in love with those, and Buster Keaton, and I'm trying to think of what else did I really love from that period. What do you, if you're a silent film guy for real, who do you like?
Well, I'm not so much, but my friend Dave was a real silent film buff, so he was obviously into all the comedians. The Keaton, the Chaplin, the Lloyd, the Lloyd B. Hamiltons, if you will. The Larry, you should pardon the expression, Larry Seaman was even the song. Honest to God.
Not what I know, but...
That was his name. I got Harry Langdon. All the comedies were the way in. And then you would tolerate some of the Lillian Gish things and the D.W. Griffith things. And, you know, again, sometimes...
Those are a little tough to take. But, yeah, Harold Lloyd, I forgot. Harold Lloyd is awesome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he was one of the few people who had a really great life, you know?
Yeah.
Well, except for blowing his finger off. That was kind of dumb.
No, he's amazing. I can't remember the one where he had to construct this crane where he goes up in a tree. It's kind of a famous shot. And it's so amazing to me to watch on Thanksgiving. You know, we always want to watch a movie. So my son and my boyfriend and I, we watched Young Sherlock with Buster Keaton.
Sherlock Jr., yeah.
Yeah, Sherlock Jr., that's it. And I'm going... Oh my God, all of this was done with there's no computers. It's just shot. They just did this.
I mean, the most famous Keaton moment is when he's standing in front of a house. And
my God.
House falls, the whole front of the house, per se, falls forward, and he's just where the window is.
Yes.
Had he not been, you know, this was not CGI... That would have been, crushed or Keaton, quite honestly, if I could hit him.
No, it's true. And also, I think that the cameraman actually turned his head so he wouldn't have to watch. He was so sure he was going to die in that shot. They all did everything. And, not silent era, but I love the Marx Brothers. Actually, Duck Soup is would have to be in my top five.
Aside from the producers, probably the best comedy ever made.
I think so. I absolutely love Duck Soup. It is so anarchic. And for years I thought it had to be Night at the Opera until I saw Duck Soup.
Oh, no, not even close.
No, it's not. They try to, get everything in the kitchen sink in that movie, and it's like, no. Duck Soup is, it's complete insanity. So
remember, boys.
I love that in, I think it's Hannah and her sisters, at the end, Woody Allen shows the clip of Duck Soup, and it snaps him out of his depression. And he says, so what if this is all there is? How bad can life be?
Exactly. And especially if you're dating a 14-year-old. That was also good for Woody Allen at the time.
That is the elephant in the room.
It's not been a good year for comedians, let me tell you.
Oh, my God, seriously. It's awful. And I loved you guys. I just read it. I don't know. There's a really great interview with Chris Rock by Frank Rich. And Chris Rock says, I just hope these things aren't true. He said, what can I say? I just don't want her to be true.
I know. I wish Joan Rivers were still alive, too. And David Brenner. We also lost him earlier this year, but knowing, that's what I'm saying. It's Joan Rivers, David Brenner, obviously the Cosby stuff going on.
Yeah.
And Robin Williams.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I mean, what a year. Good God. Gilbert Gottfried must be looking over his shoulder. But anywho, we are very happy looking forward and behind, as it were, with Nan Bauer. She is, if we wanted to say what you are now, you're a writer.
I am a writer.
And you've got the website, nanettesfeast.com. And are you still teaching?
I'm not teaching at the moment. I had to take a break because I absolutely love teaching and I absolutely hate grading. So every few years, I take about 6 months off and just go, okay, I can't face another term paper, so.
Then if you don't mind my asking, are you able to cobble together an income from writing and the web stuff?
I have had to be very careful, and honestly, right at the moment, what saves me is I used to work in advertising, and I'll get an advertising gig, and that will push me through for a while.
A gig, doing copyright or what?
Yeah, copywriting or concepting, or I do video production, so that's...
Well, that's huge. That's a big... great. Is there any particular ad or thing that you've worked on that we would know? Like, oh, you wrote that?
No, because I was always web. So, there's so much digital and website content and stuff that nobody, I don't have a great TV commercial or anything that people could go to. If you, and I don't even know if my name's all that attached because, you know, producers for this kind of video are really invisible. So, but I can tell you all about how engineering software works. If you ever want to do a call on that.
Wait, hold on. I need to sleep now.
Yeah, exactly. If you ever have like a show on insomnia and you want to help your viewers to.
Welcome to part 7 of Technical Writing Workshop.
I'm your girl.
God. God, but let me ask you: do you have a screenplay in your drawer somewhere, or an unfinished novel? I get that.
I have a finished novel. I wrote. It was based on a play that I was kind of obsessed with, and
a play that you wrote.
I wrote it back in '99. I repolished it, and I, you know, every once in a while I'll take it out and I'll throw it around. But I, you know, I look at where publishing is right now, and I here's a sad story. I live in Ann Arbor, which is the headquarters. Was the headquarters of Borders.
Oh.
Borders, you know, and I love Borders. Borders is a great bookstore. Well, Borders went under, and I went to Borders when they closed to one of their big flagship stores here. And the store is just, it's like locusts have been in, but there's a table in the middle of the store with a huge pile of books on it, and it's all novels. And it's like, they couldn't hardly give them away. And these were novels that were well reviewed by the New York Times and by publishers. What's the big?
HarperCollins.
Yeah, exactly. And they're just sitting there, and I thought, oh God, you know, I don't know that I can keep doing this, but it's been so long since I wrote the thing, and all the technology's changed. And there was actually, I saw a great thing. Somebody threw it to me on Facebook or something, and it said it was a list of all the Seinfeld episodes that could not exist now because of technology. There's just, it's changed everything so much. So that was kind of, it's like, after a while, I don't know if you or if Dave has had a screenplay sitting around in a drawer, but after a while, you just can't even look at it anymore. Yeah. You can't see it. So
I know. There's portions of the Torah that I can't even look at anymore. I just get so tired of them. But we have not tired of talking with Nan Bauer. Last question for you, because we haven't even touched on this. If I were dying, there's actually an ambulance outside as I'm saying this.
I can hear it.
In fact, if I were on death row and I begged for a last meal before they were taking me out to be shot and hanged and garroted and possibly crucified, all things considered.
What did you do, Rabbi?
Oh, you don't want to know. You don't want to know. It involves a couple of anal stewardesses in real life. But you know, and he said, we're going to get Nan Bauer to cook for you. And it doesn't have to be kosher, because at that stage, I'm not going to give a shit, quite honestly. I'll eat anything then. What would you try to wow my taste buds with for my last minutes on Earth?
You know, I'm not a fancy cook. I would probably make some really killer mashed potatoes.
Okay.
And a great salad with bacon. Let's just go for the car. We're not, you know, you're going to die anyway. So maybe like a Caesar salad with bacon, and I throw dried cherries and pistachio nuts into it.
Okay.
Meatloaf. You can't go wrong with meatloaf.
Meatloaf for a last meal. Meatloaf and mashed potatoes. This?
Or wait, I forgot about this. I don't eat it, so I forget I know how to do this. I can make a hell of a steak.
Now we're talking.
Screw the meatloaf. We'll do a filet mignon.
Okay, now what is the secret to making a wonderful filet mignon?
Okay, you have to have, the secret is, you have to have a seasoned, small, cast iron skillet.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, this is how I learned it in the restaurant. You get your oven really hot, like 500 degrees.
Okay.
You have a hot pad because the, you know, the cast iron skillet, the handle is going to get burning, boiling hot. So you don't want to grab that thing. You don't want to touch it.
Okay.
But what you're going to do is you're going to get the cast iron skillet hot on the stovetop. Okay?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And put a little, just a teeny bit of oil, just like with a pastry brush, put a little oil on there. Salt and pepper your steak. You always want to salt your food, okay? Put it down, sear it, so it's going to sizzle. It's going to get beautifully brown on one side. Flip it, put it in that hot oven, and then you take it out when you're done, which is about, you know, medium rare is pretty much where you want your filet mignon, so that's going to be approximately 5 minutes.
5 minutes. So you sear it first only on one side or both sides?
Well, it's going to sear on the other side when you flip it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah. You flip it down. And then
it's going to finish cooking in the oven, but then you just get it in the oven. But that's it. It's really about heat. People don't realize that cooking is a lot about your surface temperatures. And with meat particularly, you want to have, if people do a really bad thing, and this is that they put this cold pan on a cold stove, they put the cold oil in, and then before those have sufficiently heated, they put the food in that they want to cook, and
yeah,
it doesn't have a chance. It's just going to sit there and get all soggy from the oil. So you got to get the pan hot, then the oil hot.
Wait a minute. So you put the oil already into a really hot pan? Aren't you going to, like, get pockmarked and
No,
burned?
It won't do that. It won't do that. Because there's nothing in it. The only thing that makes the oil go all crazy is if there's water. So you get that pan, like, super hot. So, you know, you just take like, a little bit of water and just, like, a drop of water, and it should just evaporate when it hits that skillet. Then you pour your oil in. You heat that, and then you put your food in, and it's gonna crisp right out. And the other thing is, you do a little salt, and a little sugar will caramelize too.
Really, sugar? How interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nan. And if you were serving me dessert before they're carting me off to the electric chair,
taking you away. You know, we used to make at the restaurant I worked at. It was called Louie's Backyard. It was in Key West, Florida. This is where I learned to cook. We made this tart that was really great. So you have your pie crust, and you melt really good dark chocolate in the bottom.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So you melt that, but then you get it cold. So the pie crust is cooked. You get the chocolate cold, so it's like, you know, if you tap it with a spoon, it's going to break.
Okay.
And then we would make this lemon curd,
ooh,
which is like a lemon custard kind of. Pour that in, put raspberries on top. That's one that you could die after that and,
you know,
be happy, I think.
I like all sorts of tarts, quite honestly, but that's one of the tastiest.
There were the stewardesses, too, so.
There you go. Well, we have been talking with the delightful Nan Bauer here on Dave's Gone By. Everybody go to Nanette's Feast. You can tell that she is a place to go to talk about movies with your date or with your spouse or with a homeless person on the street, even, if you invite them up for a meal.
Even. They eat them, too.
And simple, normal meals that regular people can eat. You don't have to be Julia Child to do this, or even, you know, Woody Allen's child to do this. You can just
go there.
Enjoy movies, enjoy life, and we have so much enjoyed chatting with Nan Bauer. Thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood.
Thank you, Rabbi Saul Solomon.
Shalom to you.
Shalom to you, my friend. Take care.